This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
You're listening to the Design Build Hunt podcast presented by Whitetail Partners. Here we cover all things whitetail property design, habitat improvement, and hunting strategy. Let's change your property for good. Welcome back to the Design Build Hunt podcast, which is presented by Whitetail Partners. I'm your host, Josh Raley from Whitetail Partners, Georgia, and I've got a crew on the line today. I've got Dylan from Kansas, Tim from Wisconsin, Lee from Tennessee, and Jake from Michigan. It's a whole group of you, so I'm not going to ask how you're doing because nobody will answer, and then everybody will answer all at the same time, and it'll just be weird. So, Lee, I want to know how you're doing tonight.
I'm doing great, man. I got all my trees planted today. I planted a whole bunch of trees, so I got that done, checked off the list. So I'm moving on to other things.
Excellent. How many did you plant?
It was about 20, and it was, you know, some crab apples, some pears. I did some chestnuts, so I got all that done just in a new location. So I try to plant, you know, around 50-plus trees a year
right.
just to keep it going.
Right. When did you order those trees?
A while back, because it's very competitive to get your trees these days. Anywhere you want to get them. If they're a reputable company, they're sold out of all the good stuff. So,
Mossy Oak Native Nurseries has like black cherry and some kind of random plum at this point left.
Yeah. So. Hey, I buy a lot from Native Nursery. You just got to get on it. And, dude, everything I've gotten from them is solid. And I love their tree tubes as well. So super easy on the tree tubes.
Yep, for sure. You're another good option for folks. If you haven't checked with a local university, a lot of universities will sell trees and they're selling them cheap because, I mean, I've gotten some of them for, you know, $12, $13 a tree, $10 a tree for ones that I would have paid $25 a tree or $27 a tree somewhere else. And so you can get really good pricing with that. But again, you've got to be in early. Like you've got to be placing orders in September, October for to get them the following spring. So, you know, there is a little bit of work involved. Tim, man, I want to know, have you been out working on your own property any? Have you been getting some projects done?
Yeah, we were talking about that right before we started, right? It's you get so busy being on other people's properties and working on their jobs, your own property kind of falls behind. So we're about 2 weeks away from things slowing down on the consulting side, and then I'm ready to dive in and get some of that stuff done on my own. Hopefully it's not too late.
Right, right. Yeah, you should have a little bit more time there in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And even from where Sam is in the south part of the state to where I am in more of the central part of the state, we're probably 2 weeks behind them. So now we've got plenty of time, but the more conversations I have and the more I'm hearing, you know, Lee's getting trees in the ground and everybody's doing stuff, I'm anxious to get going.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So Dylan, what about you, man? What have you been up to?
Yeah, I actually did get some trees in the ground as well here the last couple of weeks and got them watered, got a little bit of natural rain as well. So that was nice, but do have a lot of timber burns on the slate. So hopefully I can squeeze those in as well. So I'm looking forward to doing some work here coming up.
Excellent. What are you planting out there in Kansas?
I actually take advantage of the tree program we've got here through K-State University and Kansas Forest. They actually have some really good offerings, kind of seedling bundles. I do some bare root seedlings in groups of 25. And so typically I try to mix in some shrubs along with some tree plantings. But this last round did some persimmon, so I'm kind of trying some of that out. A few other plums, but yeah, just really want to get that kind of established. I grew up doing that with my dad, kind of instilled that in us, and it's just kind of a neat deal. You get that box from him, and a matter of fact, there's a smell to it that kind of reminded me of my childhood. I used to hate it when I was younger, but now I'm trying to pass it on to my kids and have a little child labor camp work out of them, maybe.
There you go. Jake, what about you? You been getting out?
Yeah, I try to get out, you know, a little bit every day, you know, maybe an hour or so. And right now we're kind of just taking some trees down, not food plot season yet. So still taking trees down, create more bedding. I'm trying to extend one of our food plots that's within the timber. So I've got a lot of the larger trees girdled. So those guys are dead, but there's a lot of smaller trees in there that I'm taking down and then using the logs for another project. So.
Gotcha. Excellent. Excellent. Well, you guys are doing better than me. I've done zero. I've done nothing this spring. But hey, you know what? That's okay. That's all right. We've had the property for 17 years at this point. So it's, you know, it's, we know what we need to do there, but, not a lot of time to get out onto our own place. Been a good consulting season so far. So, guys, we've got another Q&A today. So the last episode was Q&A. We ended up focusing specifically on food plots. We had so many food plot questions come in, needed to answer them from a couple of different perspectives, and so wanted to make sure we could get those questions covered. Today, we're going to do a little bit of a mix of everything, and I want to kick it off with this question because this is one that I get a lot, and a lot of clients have tried to do this specific thing on their property. Some have had great success. Some have had no success at all, and some have had some mixed success, and that's trying to use mock scrapes. So mock scrapes make it onto pretty much all of our plans. And some of us will put a lot of mock scrapes. Some of us will have just a few. But when it comes to a mock scrape, what is it that's going to increase the odds that actually, let me back up a little bit. When you put out a mock scrape on your property, how certain are you that that mock scrape is going to be taken over and used?
100%.
100%. All right, Dylan, what about you?
Yeah, you struck a nerve there. To be honest, I wasn't sure that question was going to come out tonight, but that's a whole podcast in itself, in my opinion. But that's my number one favorite tactic of all, and I lean on it heavily.
Yeah, yeah. Lee, what about you?
Same here. It's very high. You know, I'd put it close to 100%. I'm trying to think of one that failed, so right. I'm going to say 100%.
Right. Tim?
Yeah, you'd have to really put it in the wrong spot and do a poor job to not have a chance to get that established.
Yeah. All right. So I'm talking with clients who've tried them on their property, zero luck. Okay. Nothing ever hits the thing. I've put out mock scrapes before through the learning process that were not picked up on, were not used. I've had mock scrapes that sat for a month or two and then started getting hit. I've had mock scrapes that we kept going year after year, and it was hit in the second year. But a lot of these are placement issues or things that I can now identify. So what goes into building a quality mock scrape? Maybe the first best question that we need to ask is, where do we put these things to get our success rate up from 10% to, like you guys are saying, almost 100?
Like Dylan said, this could be an episode in itself because there's so much that goes into like a mock scrape, but I guess you want to try to put it on their corridor, their path that they're taking, regardless of where it's going, from two different focal points, whether that's a bedding area or a bedding area, food plot to food plot, bedding area to food plot. And I really like placing these on intersections. So a lot of my stand locations, they're not going to be just on one trail. I'm going to try to build two corridors into one area, so we have an intersection, and that's where I'm going to place my mock scrape. And a deer will go out of his way to hit a mock scrape, you know, within reason, like maybe 10 yards, 15 yards, but you can't just put a mock scrape in the middle of the open hardwoods and think a deer is going to hit it. It's not like a bait pile or something like that. It's not an attraction like that. It's something that they're going to hit along the way to communicate with the rest of the deer herd. And like the best example or comparison that I can think of for a mock scrape is if like you guys have dogs, when you take your dog for a walk, that dog has to pee and smell the same stuff on that walk every single time. Right. And that's the same way that deer use mock scrapes. You know, we can go into it a little further than that, but I mean, that's kind of the basics. They're using these scrapes to communicate with one another, and every deer hits that scrape on those travel routes. And so that's the biggest thing for me is keeping it on the travel route or really close to it. And if you can, put it on an intersection. That way you just have more deer hitting it, and then it's just going to get better over time. Like what you said, Josh, like it got better that second year. I view mock scrapes like, and it sounds bad, I guess, but like the first year is the worst year. Now, the first year is not bad. The first year is good. But every year after that, it's going to get better and better and better, because those deer just keep hitting it, and they remember that scrape. That's part of their routine. You're conditioning those deer. You know, I think of it kind of like your 401k. It just keeps compounding and compounding, right? Like it just gets better over time. So that would be my mock scrape answer.
Yeah, I like that. Any other feedback on, you know, locating these scrapes, where they should be?
I really well, like
you
the
talked
intercept.
About.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say you talked about, you know, you might pull a deer a little ways to the scrape, but looking at that conversely, I want that deer to actually have to go out of its way to not run into that scrape. I mean, right in the middle of the trail, right at their nose height. I mean, I want to make it as easy as possible that they actually have to exert energy to not stop by and smell it. And like you said, the deer or like a dog walking down the street, if that fire hydrant's there, if that tree is there, they always walk past. It's right there. They're not going to just walk past it. They're going to stop every time.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's kind of been my strategy as well, is number one, like you said, making sure that if they're going to not hit the scrape, they had to dodge it. You know, they had to dodge the limb or the rope or whatever it is that I'm using in that specific location. But again, making sure it's at the intersection of trails or, you know, the edge of a bedding location or near where a couple of bedding spots are where, you know, travel routes come out of those bedding locations. Well, then that's a good spot for a mock scrape to be. Dylan or Lee, any tips for helping us get our mock scrapes off the ground? If we're struggling with it and we say, okay, we're going to find, you know, X marks the spot. We're going to find where travel routes converge. We're going to try to put a mock scrape there and we're going to make the deer avoid it. Any other tips for getting it started?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add in there that, yeah, you can be just off the mark and it might make a significant difference. You may not know it, but you could be just, you know, matter of yards away and it's just inconvenient enough. But the one thing that does set it apart is once you're in there and getting those locations, being as scent free as you can and not being as much of a disturbance to it is really key as well. But the one thing that I like to do is if you do have those multiplication, other scrapes in the area, is eliminate those scrapes. Without that forehead licking branch, that scrape's going to die. And so you may have to do that to narrow that down to where you want them. Or if you've got those areas where there are some scrapes in undesirable locations that may be on a more of an iffy wind, you might want to eliminate those for that reason. If your setup, it absolutely has to be there, which, you know, that's another whole podcast probably on setups. But as far as wind direction and all that kind of stuff and hunting over scrapes, that's, you'll see a lot of differences there.
Right. Right. All right, well, let's move on to this one. This is a question that I get pretty frequently, and I'm sure you guys do too. Basically, it comes down to this. How careful do I need to be with my deer property? Can I enjoy the property? Can I go on walks? Can the kids roam free? Can my friend ride his UTV around if he likes to do that? How careful do I really need to be? I don't want to invest in just a deer preserve as my mother likes to remind my father from time to time, we don't live on a deer preserve. So what's the balance there? What does that look like?
It's a tough question, you know, and, you know, because we all want to recreate on our properties. We all love our properties. And you know, obviously different times of year, you're going to want to intrude and then not intrude on your property. But you know, I'd say a lot goes into the size of the property on, you know, you're obviously going to be, it's going to be more lenient and tolerant of intrusion if you own a 1,000-acre property versus 30, and you're trying to, you know, have a certain goal for that 30-acre property of holding, growing, and harvesting mature bucks annually. That 30 acres is going to be a little more sensitive than that 1,000. You know, so, but it's all about timing. Like right now, we're all intruding. I'm going in areas of my property that I never go in past a certain point. So I think there's times to recreate and then times to not. My shut off, I try to get all my work done by August and I'm done. I do not go back into some core areas that are designed for sanctuary. I like maintaining 80%+ sanctuary integrity on my property and my clients' properties to achieve those goals that I just laid out. So I say do it early if you're going to recreate, and then have a firm cutoff is what I tell my clients, to say, hey, no more foiler riding past July or August, you know, and let everything settle back in, because the bucks, if they see you're, if they're moving into that winter ground, they may be on the neighbor's property anyways, you know, or somewhere else, or just depends on what your property's DNA is and how they're using it. So a lot of things there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Others?
Yeah. I would.
Yeah. I think you can definitely, I'm stepping on you guys tonight. I think you can definitely get away with more impact on certain areas in your property than others. You know, if we're staying in the perimeter, if we're not going close to those core bedding areas, it's going to be a lot less impactful. And I think you can do it a little more often. If you're saying, hey, we want to have some walking trails or some ATV trails, keep them to the outside. I mean, you think about if somebody walks past your house, that's not going to, you know, set off any red flags if they walk past on the sidewalk, right? But now if they walk through your kitchen in the middle of the night, you're going to, you know, that's a big deal. So it's the same thing with deer. They know, you know, where people typically are. And if we're staying outside of that area that feels secure to them, you can get away with a lot more of that.
Right. Yeah. That's a really, really good point. On our family property, we've got a pond that we enjoy fishing in. We've got a gazebo there, and we also plant this rather large food plot for our property. And we'll go down there and fish during the day. And we go sit in this large blind with grandkids in the afternoon and evening. And when we leave, there's not great screening. The deer watch us get out of the blind at this point, kind of wave at us, and we go on about our day, just because it's become an area that they are so accustomed to seeing us, because we don't shoot them there. We watch them with, you know, the kids or the grandkids. We enjoy them. We're in there all times of the day. And, but you better believe, so the swamp is just on the backside. When we step foot in the swamp, it's a whole other game. It's like the deer, it's like that's when they're like, okay, he's here for something else. Like he, you know, they're here and they mean business this time. But yeah, certain locations I think you can, you know, set aside, hey, this is the spot with the pond, and we've got kids and grandkids and we want to enjoy that, then by all means, set that apart as something to enjoy. Jake, you live on your property, correct?
I do, yep.
So walk me through what that looks like for you as far as trying to maintain that balance, because you've got young kids and you want to enjoy the property, but at the same time, you want to have great hunting.
Right. So my answer was going to be very similar to what Lee's was, and it's kind of all about timing. So once the season is over, for us, it's January 1st, there's no place on our property that's off limits. You know, we will go anywhere we want, and one, to improve it. We want to continue to improve our entire property. That's the only way it's going to get better, hold more deer, hold older deer. But once we get to that certain time of the year, and for me, that's Labor Day. That's the last, or around Labor Day. It's when we're broadcasting our cereal rye into our food plots, and then we're kind of backing out. And after that, we are not stepping foot outside of, you know, certain areas on our property until January 1st. And so that's where design comes in and habitat improvements. So there are areas on our property, like what Tim alluded to, that the deer are used to us being. So my house is set way far back on our property. The deer are very used to us here, but because of that, they don't really come by our house. So with the design, we have to kind of wrap that around the house, because that's what they want to do anyways, and then put all of our improvements kind of away from that. So we still have like a family area and then a deer hunting area. But we, after September 1st, we do not go into that deer hunting area, or like where the sanctuary, unless we're going to go into hunt.
Right, right. I'm curious what you guys think, and maybe we could just rapid fire this one, because this isn't a listener Q&A. This is just my question. When it comes to ATVs on a property, side by sides on a property, what do you guys think, man? They're loud. They're smelly. They're sure nice to get around in, though. So what do you guys think?
Hunting season or not hunting season? What are we talking about here?
Hunting season for sure.
Yeah, I would say no go on that. At least on my property here, it's too small. Like, they would hear you coming. They would start associating that noise with pressure. They would figure it out pretty quick. So for me, that would be a no go.
I'm a no go in hunting season. I'm an absolute believer in it all the way up to a certain point, you know, but I run trap lines and there's just no way that I can efficiently, you know, do that by foot. So I'm in and out of my property on ATVs all the time. Does not affect them. They get used to it. There's certain areas I can't run cellular cameras, and I've got to run those old cameras, but it's in some pretty intrusive areas and I only check them just a couple times a year, but it's in a great spot. When I go check them, I ride in there and I never turn that off. You know, the four-wheeler off, because they associate that with I'm in and out of these, you know, maintenance roads all the time on my ATV. They don't associate it with danger. The minute I cut it off and start squirming around in there, they notice, and it does, you know, it does alarm them. So I off season, I'm totally fine with it, to stay on those maintenance roads, and, you know, hunt season, no bueno, no, not doing it.
I like it. We have gone to all electric on our property during hunting season, and for us, that's worked out really well, whether that be an e-bike, or I don't know if you guys have seen some of the new electric side-by-sides.
Golf cart.
So we've got a golf cart, but they make some now that are basically like a Polaris Ranger, but it's, you know, four-wheel drive and everything, but it's all electric. So those are pretty incredible machines. So, all right, we're going to move on here just a little bit. Let's talk about bedding areas real quick. How big does a bedding area really need to be? What do you guys like to do as far as size on your bedding locations?
I'll go. So if I'm doing like a lot of my properties that I'm working on are bedding areas within the timber. So we're taking down a lot of trees, whether that's you're getting it logged off and then you're going in to do detail work, or you're going in to do all the work yourself. But I like to do anywhere from about a quarter acre to a half acre area that I'm removing a lot of the trees. And I don't know if this is going to be a question later, but I like to remove a lot of the trees, almost all of the trees, just so I can get full sunlight into that area to start getting that regrowth that we want. That's going to actually encourage bedding, but probably around, you know, a quarter acre to a half acre. And the reason that I'm not clear cutting the whole area is because we still want to have edge. And each one of those bedding areas is going to create an edge. And so you can build your travel corridors off of these different bedding areas. And that's how you can kind of steer deer through your property. And also that separates deer. So you can have maybe a bedding area towards the top of the hill. You cut a quarter acre on the top of this hill. You cut a quarter acre on the bottom of the hill. Now you're also giving these deer options. So it's not that you're going to have deer in every single one of your cuts, but depending on the weather, the wind, the personality of the deer, they have a lot of options to pick from. So you can hold more deer on your property, and you can also, you know, depending on the personality of the deer, the buck, hopefully he chooses your property more times than not, you know, if he has a lot of, you know, bedding choices in the area. So for me, it's about a quarter acre to a half acre bedding cuts.
Okay. Others?
Very similar to Jake on my timber cuts. I do have, you know, some larger areas as well. We could do a whole podcast on this as well. But if you're talking about like a switchgrass, you know, different type of bedding, you know, outside the timber, I like to have those an acre plus. You know, I don't like having something too small that predators can move in and out of that. And I like to have, you know, a larger plot, you know, an acre plus. Just me personally, that's what I do. But I have quite a few of those smaller, like Jake, you know, quarter acre. I've got a lot of those in my property, because, you know, deer don't just bed in one location. You can't just go out there and hinge cut a tree and say, oh, that's where that buck is going to go. That's not how that works. You know, they, you got to think it's a natural thing. You know, if they're going to bed in the same location over and over and over and over and over again, these deer smell, and they're telling predators, their natural predators, hey, I'm here every night, you know, come eat me. They don't do that. They naturally go to certain locations, and it can be based on wind. I love putting my cameras on bedding areas and watch when they come there, why they're there, the wind direction. But they move around in that certain area. So I like to have them options, you know, different wind options, locations. Mississippi State does a lot of good radio collar studies on this. And boy, that, you know, a deer will bed at 20 or 30 different locations. You know, it's not just one. So, you know, we could have a whole podcast around this, but I like to vary my sizes. And, you know, I've got a 30 acre timber harvest that I did. And you wouldn't believe how many deer, you know, are bedding in that, and a lot of, you know, quality bucks, doe families. So it all depends on the DNA, your property, size of your property, you know, how you're going to structure your food, you know, against that. And then your travel routes, like all of that has to go into account before you just go start hacking away, you know, at trees. So,
right. Right. Yeah. I'm going to say, you know, it is pretty situational, property to property, right? I mean, on a smaller property, my bedding locations are going to be smaller. They're going to be more to that quarter acre kind of size. On a larger property, you can start to get a little bit bigger, larger bedding areas. On, you know, for us, we've got a lot of production pine properties. And so, you know, when we're clear cutting 20 acres at a time, well, I can't, you know, hey, Mr. Logger, will you just clear cut like that quarter acre right there and leave that for me and, you know, leave the rest of it for another year. so we kind of have to work with what we've got. So we've got some bedding areas that are, you know, quite large, 15, 20 acres of very good, thick bedding cover. But then right next to those, we may have another quarter acre bedding cut because it's kind of in more of a hardwood setting, or, you know, we're trying to open up the canopy without, you know, logging help. So it's very, very situational. I think the larger the property you have, the bigger the bedding area you can get away with. But I think rather than worrying about a specific size, I would rather say, okay, does the topography lay out well here? And can I feasibly get a bedding location in here? And does it work for my access and egress to where I can slip in and hunt around it undetected? Because I do like to hunt kind of close, kind of tight on some of my bedding locations when I can. And so I would rather just say, I'm just going to tailor it to each one than trying to say, this one's not quite a quarter acre yet. I'm just going to get in there and do what needs to be done. Put in there what can fit in there that works with my hunting strategy. Let's see. Next question going on here. I like this one. We kind of alluded to this earlier, and actually two different questions that kind of tie in together. How big of a sanctuary do I really need? How much of my property really needs to be sanctuary? And then I want to follow up with this question. How important is depth of cover? Let's go with opinions. Somebody's going to disagree on this one.
So the sanctuary one is going to vary, just like we talked about right there with bedding areas, like the size can differ on depending on property size. The sanctuary piece is going to differ too. Like you can have a larger percent of your property in sanctuary. Sometimes the larger the property is, but it's also almost more important to have more of your property in sanctuary the smaller your property is, because you have less room for error on a smaller property. So you know, if you can get to that 80%, like that what Lee was talking about earlier, that's phenomenal, because you still have to incorporate access, you know, getting to different stand locations, having multiple stands for different winds, time of day, you know, so you do have to get around your property. You still have to hunt your property. But like, so if you can get to 80%, that's really good. But like, if I'm just trying to think of like plans that I've put together recently, you know, a lot of them are like in that 70-75% range, I feel like, on some of the good ones, because again, you still have to get around it. But and these are right. These are smaller properties. But and then the depth of cover, I think it is important. I think, but it again, this is the last podcast. I think I had it depends. It depends on the depth of cover. So if you have, and I would say that this is kind of the area, the neighborhood in general. So if you have an area that is, let's say, a big wood setting, I think depth of cover is very important. if you have a food source on your property and you don't have any cover near that food source, those deer can go anywhere to bed down. And when they're going to relate to that food source, they could be a long ways away. So that's where you need to start establishing cover areas on your property to get those does or those deer closer to that food source. And then those bucks are going to kind of, they're still going to relate to that food source, but they're going to kind of be off by themselves somewhere and what they deem is the safest available spot. But if that safest available spot is the first available spot, then those does might take that place up and then that might push those bucks out. So in a very heavy cover scenario where, you have ag field for miles, I think it's very, very important. Flip that over to like the opposite where it's nothing but it's open everywhere. You have very limited cover. I think you can stack a lot of deer on top of each other. You could put them all in the same 10-acre bedding area. You could have old bucks, young bucks, does, all of them in the same bedding area. And I've seen it multiple times in these big ag settings where all these deer come filing out of that old, this little swale behind the farmer's house that no one can go in, and they're all, it's a 10-acre swamp, but they're all in there. And there's no depth of cover in there. they're just all jammed in there because they know no one can go in there. And so that's a scenario where, it's not necessarily, so a smaller property maybe, or an area where there's not a lot of cover. I've just seen it where it's not as important. Like you can fit a lot of deer in a small spot if you give them the best cover in the area.
Right. Right. Anybody want to follow up on that?
Yeah. Real quick, Josh, I'd just like to say, Jake, you covered so many good points right there. I don't have a lot to add to that other than even a smaller property. What I was going to say is there's a lot of friendships and relationships you can build with your neighbors to kind of understand how they utilize their properties. And around, at least in my area, there's a lot of properties that you may know are going to be kind of sanctuary on surrounding properties. So you can kind of build that into what your sanctuaries are. And maybe you don't have as much to designate for sanctuary, but if you've got it to where you can design around those areas that you know are, that's beneficial. I mean, you're kind of expanding your zone there a little bit on what's cover, and what becomes potentially bedding and safe havens for them and good escape cover for if you did have too much pressure on it. But I think just figuring that in addition to your own property can sometimes be helpful.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. And we often talk about this from a almost not quite adversarial, but a competition kind of way when we think about, designing according to what the neighboring land looks like or is doing or, kind of playing off of that. But if you've got a good relationship with your neighbor, I mean, this is an area where you could actually cooperate with one another and say, hey, this, both our hunting will be better on both sides of the fence if we can do this, these couple of things and protect this certain area. One of the things that I have found time and time again on so many properties that are hunted in a way that is maybe not the most careful is, yes, I do think that depth of cover is important and I design that way. At the same time, I can almost guarantee you that there is a buck bed somewhere keeping tabs on human access every single time. Like I can pretty much put money on it. 90% of the properties are going to have a buck bedding somewhere where he can keep tabs on human intrusion onto and off of the property. Are you guys seeing the same thing?
Yeah. I just left a job in Kentucky that, it was a heavy pronounced buck bedding area and he was just right there, literally 100 yards in the trailhead there, for sure. So yeah. So, and I think that could be a lot, going on there, Josh. I would say 90% of our clients, what we see is they're starting and they're parking at the front and they're intruding into their core almost every single time. Right. So where do those bucks go? They go up to the front where nobody is hunting.
Right.
There was no stands there. There's hardly ever stands right by where the truck is parked. Guess where the buck's going to be? He's always by the house. He's always by the thicket right by somebody's house that no human ever walks in that thicket. Because, why would you? There's no deer. There's nothing. There's no opportunity there. That's what people think. And sometimes that's where the biggest buck is, And a lot of times it's right up there by the gate or, it's just where nobody's going. Nobody's messing with them. They're safe.
Yeah. Yeah. And just as you're talking, it makes me think, like, even though it's right there by the access, it actually may be the best depth of cover because the way they might be hunting it, right? Like, yeah, it jumping right into the core, it's like, well, your best depth of cover was that 100 yards, from the gate to where he was bedded. So, man, good stuff. Good stuff.
Hey, can I say something about the sanctuary too, real quick? Absolutely. Just, because we see so many different properties, and I think it's so important, the DNA of that property, because a lot of times you'll have a hub on the neighbor's property, a big hub, and then another hub on the other neighbor's property, and the client owns the arterial travel, and that's it, and it's literally, you're going to have awesome pre-rut peak and then the tail end of the post, like you're hunting the travel, and that's the DNA of that property. So you don't really have to, you've got the best of the world, and in my opinion, you really don't have to do a lot but hunt the travel. You got to keep that travel, encourage that travel, make sure that habitat doesn't change, a lot, but let them go hub to hub, go mess with those does. And that's what we all try to, we love hunting pre-rut, and I love hunting post-rut, but so it depends on the DNA when you start talking about sanctuary and how much sanctuary should I have. That guy, I'm going to say, man, you've got a dream come true. You don't really have to do a ton of work. You're hunting. You just have to be precision strikes on this property. When should you be here and why? And hunt that condensed travel and that arterial travel. Like, those are awesome properties. what I'm saying?
Right.
So, but anyways. Yeah.
I think a lot of times, that's a little bit of a process. It can be, but learning the strengths of your property and learning to let it be that, like, we've talked about it before on this podcast, right? Finding a property and trying to make that property do everything, try to put everything on that property, and you end up shooting yourself in the foot a little bit because not every property does everything equally well. I was on a property last week in Alabama. And kind of what you were saying, but there's a larger ridge with a fire break running, parallel with the ridge, and then a lot of little finger ridges that go out from there. Early season, he gets a couple bucks on camera. They disappear. Rut comes. He's got bucks up and down this fire break or road system on this ridge, checking all of these little finger ridges for does. I mean, it's an absolute highway. It was tore up with scrapes. And, one of his goals is to improve the hunting kind of in the middle of the season, outside of the rut. And that, that is something that we're going to try to do. But again, that comes back to just making sure we understand the DNA of the property. It may just be a really great, pre-rut and rut timeframe property. And if we try too hard to make it a good, middle of October property, which here the rut's not until, late December, first week of January, and on this specific farm. If we try to make it a great October, mid-October to late October property, we may end up doing things that are detrimental to our hunting later on in the year. So, all right, last question, and this is a general deer management kind of question, right? When you start working on a property, you're very quickly going to see a response from the deer. You start putting quality cover, you start putting quality food. Next thing you know, you're going to be like, wow, there's a lot of deer here. Way more deer than I thought. How do you determine what your doe harvest should be? Are you doing that by observations and on the stand? Is there a specific time of year that you're making those observations or taking an inventory of the deer that you have? And then if so, which deer are you trying to harvest? Or is it, hey, we know we need to get 10 off the property this year, so we're taking 10?
I might not be able to come up with a number necessarily. And I'm not sure, maybe some of you have a formula that you can figure out exactly how many does you need to take off a property. But one of the things that I look at is getting out of my property after hunting season's done and, the winter has set in, and let's look at the browse pressure. Is there still food available for the deer besides what I threw in my food plots? Is everything just hammered? Are they going on to some of the less desirable species already? And I realize some of that can depend on the severity of the winter, but that's also going to be indicative of how many deer you have versus kind of the holding capacity with the habitat. So I think that's maybe a non-scientific way to do it, but a way to get a feel for maybe what should be there versus what is.
Right. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah,
that's really good.
Same as what Tim said. You know, kind of this. You're looking at indicators. You know, what's the browse pressure like? Are you carrying food into the following season? And just like what Tim said, you know, that could either mean you have too many deer, or that could mean you need to add more food. You know, kind of, if you only have a half acre food plot on 100 acres, well, you might need to add some more food to your property. It might not be that you have too many deer. It just means you need to add more food. Another way that you can help determine your kind of your area's population is just by talking with your neighbors, like what Dylan said earlier. You know, you just have this area that's a sanctuary. Let's, you know, keep that as a sanctuary. You know, by talking with the neighbors, you talk with them about the deer numbers that they're seeing. Okay, you know, we're all out hunting on this Saturday. You know, the guys on your property can, you know, make an observation, and you can talk with your neighbors as well and talk about how many they're seeing. You can kind of get, you know, it's not going to be an exact number, but you can kind of get close. You can start figuring out what the population is like in your area. And if each person is seeing, you know, 6 to 7 deer from their stand and they're all going to different spots, well, maybe we need to start harvesting a few more does. So, you know, if you're doing it by yourself, it can be more difficult. But, you know, having cameras out there is a great way as well. If you're seeing all these deer coming by your cameras at the same time, you know, they're not moving from one camera to the next, but around the same time, you can start to kind of put those numbers together. But yeah, working with your neighbors, if you have a local cooperative, that's a great tool for management, because it's not only on you. It's not only on you to harvest all these does. You can also work with your neighbors to kind of help manage the population. And then I would say for timing, you know, I would say mid season would be a good time, because here in Michigan anyways, or up north, if you start getting into that late season after everyone has cut their crops and there's not a lot of food, you might be getting some false positives on how many deer numbers you have. So if you have, let's say your property has all the food and you're seeing all kinds of deer, well, that makes sense because you're the only one that has food. And so you might be saying, oh my gosh, we got to kill all these does because we just have way too many. But they're really, you're pulling deer in from all over the place. And so you might be getting an inflated number. So, you know, maybe, you know, late October, early November, you know, corn is still up. Your fall food plots are performing. Everyone's food plots are performing. This is your deer population. You know, that might be a good time to take maybe like a census. But yeah, late season when it's you might either say, oh, we have no deer because you don't have fall or late season food, or you might be seeing way too many deer because you're the one that has the food. So it's kind of variable.
Right. So yeah, very important to make sure we're taking a holistic picture. We're not just going out and taking a census late season, or not just going out early season and basing everything off of that. And I think it, like you said, it's a combination of sightings on the stand. It's a combination of what the browse pressure is showing us. If you can put exclusion cages on your food plots, I think those are awesome. A lot of times, and I've seen it time and time again this year, even being on client properties, and they say, this food plot just didn't do well this year. But you look close and it's like, no, the deer aren't letting it do well this year. I mean, it's getting absolutely hammered. So could it have done better? Probably. And, you know, reducing deer numbers is probably pretty important. But one thing to remember, kind of like you said, this, the cooperative piece is going to be huge. I mean, if you're, you know, we work with a lot of landowners who have 30 or 40 acres. And if you're saying, what should my doe harvest be? It's like, there are so many variables outside of your property that are going to influence the number of deer in your area that it's almost impossible to have a good prescription of you need to take this many deer off of your 30 acres this year. It's just really, really tough. So, Lee, I know you...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you try to get out there towards the end of the year and harvest quite a few does in your area. And you also mentioned, though, that you have kind of a lower deer density. So
yeah.
What's your strategy on that?
So one, I really like a low deer density, and for a lot of reasons. It you know, frees up your access. You know, access in and out is a lot easier when you have less eyes and ears out there. So I love that. You know, your rut seems to be, you know, the bucks are way more responsive to calls. So I love all that. But the question was, you know, kind of when, how. Jake and Tim summed it up really well. I love the indicators of my food plots. I like 5 to 8%, you know, food to total land volume ratio. And, if all that's gone, you know, depending on when, like it's still, I still have soybeans out there right now. So that's an indicator. They're almost gone, but you know, I'm not an imbalance, you know, and I pay attention to my cameras as well. Like Jake said, if you have a lot of doe families that are on these food sources and you see them standing up and they're fighting in every other picture, you know, that's an indicator that either one, they're definitely competing for that primary bedding right on that food source. And there's not enough. You're going to see them fighting a lot. I love early season and late season because this is, I love the camaraderie of hunting with my friends, but I also am passionate about the management of a trophy whitetail, getting to that mature age class. And sometimes those clash on smaller acres of having a lot of hunt buddies out, plus trying to maintain a sanctuary integrity of your property. So my doe hunts, we have annual doe hunts, and then plus like some cull bucks we want to take off the property. That is my camaraderie, you know, stage with my friends. It's like, hey, I need to take X amount of does off, and these three bucks that are just terribly, you know, the genetics are terrible. We'll do it early and then late, and I don't, you know, do anything in the middle, obviously, because I'm more precision strikes, pre-rut, peak, and post. But love having the camaraderie of my friends come out on my annual doe hunts early bow season, and then late as well, like hunting over food sources. It's a great time to bring kids, and they just see a lot of deer late season on food sources. So that's my strategy every year. I love hunting low deer densities. It's my, like, I just get stressed out, you know, hunting when I see 40 deer. Like, it's, I know that seems crazy, but I don't like those environments as much. It's not as enjoyable to me. It's a lot more challenging when you have 50, 60 deer all around you at all times to target a mature buck and kill them successfully year over year. It's way more difficult in high deer densities, in my opinion.
Right. Good stuff. Well, guys, we're going to go ahead and call it here. We've got several questions that we did not have time to get to. If you're watching this or listening to this and you have a question, now Spotify allows you to actually submit questions to us. So you can do that there, or you can do it on YouTube. Leave it in the comments of a question that you have, and we will do our best to get that question answered in one of our upcoming Q&As, because I think we're going to do this a little bit more often. This has been a lot of fun. It's fun to really kick around ideas and thoughts from kind of around the country, a bunch of different deer managers here on the line. So, guys, anything you want to leave the listener with?
Yeah, I would say just as a general theme to kind of put a bow on everything we talked about in this episode is I think there are very few absolutes. And so I think that's something good to keep in mind is what works for one person or what works for one property, one part of the country might not be what's best for you. So always keep that in mind and kind of look at that context that there's no right or wrong answer for most of these questions. It's somewhere in the middle. And I love that we have a lot of different perspectives here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And if you need more help, give a call to your local Whitetail Partners associate, whatever we're called. What are we called? I don't know what we're called. Consultant. give one of us a call and we'll maybe be able to help you out for your specific region. But guys, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for listening to this week's show. If you found this helpful, do us a favor and leave us a review wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram @whitetail_partners, on Facebook, Whitetail Partners LLC, on YouTube by simply searching Whitetail Partners, or online at whitetailpartners.com.